Hi everyone, welcome to EHS This Week's podcast for the week ending March the 28th. I'm Nicolette Acuna.
And I'm Allison Gracie. Thanks for joining us.
And I think we're going to start off with a story about a deadly East Harlem gas leak.
Yeah, so about 2 weeks ago now, on March 12th, there was a terrible explosion in East Harlem, New York. So the explosion killed 8 people, injured more than 60, and completely destroyed 2 buildings. Officials believe that the cause of this explosion was a natural gas leak, and it now appears that a 127-year-old cast iron gas line is at least partially to blame. The age of the gas main isn't necessarily a problem, but cast iron material is. So gas lines made with this material are prone to cracks and jarring that can be caused by nearby construction work. Now, any of us living in North American cities know how common construction is. So based on what we know about this cast iron material, it's probably no surprise that older cities with a higher concentration of these kinds of gas lines also have higher than average amounts of unaccounted for natural gas. In other words, natural gas leaks. So data from the U.S. Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration confirms this. This includes older cities like New York, Chicago, Philadelphia, and Boston. Natural gas leaks are common in these urban areas. Some are so small that they're completely harmless, but others are potentially explosive concentrations of natural gas that could be ignited by something as small as a stray cigarette butt.
So what this tragedy in East Harlem kind of teaches us is that these natural gas leaks can be disasters waiting to happen.
Exactly. Con Edison, which provides natural gas service in Manhattan, the Bronx, and Northern Queens, has experienced 105,000 gas leaks since just 2009. 12,000 of those were conclusively linked to corroded pipes. Now, Con Edison has already made 87 compensation payments following the blast to the people affected, though it's unclear how much was paid. They've also announced this week that they'll be giving compensation payments to business owners whose shops are near the site of the explosion.
So it sounds like they're being quite responsive, because just before the explosion, Con Edison crews were already responding to a report of a gas odor in the area, and they were also providing updates through their Twitter account on the day of the explosion.
Yeah, it's great to see that the company is handling it well, and interesting to see the role social media is playing in EHS crisis situations these days. So Con Edison confirmed the report of a gas odor in the area was made at 9:13 that morning via Twitter, and updates from the company throughout the morning were retweeted by hundreds of people.
I think what most people care about at this point, though, is making sure something like this doesn't happen again.
I agree. Unfortunately, these natural gas lines are located under streets, which makes them pretty difficult to reach. So it looks like it's actually going to take decades and billions of dollars to replace these pipes. More specifically, it's estimated that it will take over 40 years and cost $7 to $10 billion for Con Edison to carry out their plan to replace 828 miles of cast iron and unprotected steel gas main that the state considers leak-prone. So Council Speaker Melissa Mark-Viveretto says that the state isn't investing as much in infrastructure as they should be. And with so much aging infrastructure and now this explosion, it looks like this will become a hot topic in New York and in other large North American cities in the upcoming months. Nicola, I think you have a story to share with us on whistleblower complaints in the food industry?
Yes, that's right. So food industry employers may need to take a hard look at their processes for handling employee complaints about food safety issues because of a new interim final rule about how whistleblower complaints are going to be handled in the future. The new rule, published February 19th by OSHA, makes it easier for an employee to establish a whistleblower case under the Food Safety Modernization Act's whistleblower protection provisions. So the rule lowers the standards for what employees need to prove when they make a complaint. So an employee will just have to have an objectively reasonable belief that something has happened that they think is a violation or a potential violation of the act. The game changer is that this new rule adopts a more lenient standard for retaliation claims, creating the potential for more claims and a greater exposure to liability, particularly arising out of complaints that might be viewed as everyday complaints about work-related issues in these environments.
Is there anything organizations can be doing to help prepare for this new rule?
Yes, so the article actually outlines 2 steps that food industry companies should take to prepare for the new rule. So first, companies should make sure there is a process in place to respond appropriately to an employee's complaints about potential food safety violations. So a documentation process that can show how the investigation of the complaint was handled and resolved is vital. And employers need to be able to show that they investigated a complaint and addressed it in an appropriate way. This process should include training first-line supervisors about these processes, including training about how important it is to deal with a complaint in a serious and professional way. And second, employers should be able to show that any adverse action following the complaint, such as an employee's termination or demotion, was independent of that complaint. So performance documentation processes should be uniform for all employees, and a company that has a performance process in place with memos in the file about performance-related issues can then hand those to OSHA in response to a complaint. So with increased focus on whistleblower provisions, employers are beginning to understand the need to create a culture of compliance where employees can bring issues to you and can trust that you're going to take them seriously, resolve them appropriately, and that you'll not react in a retaliatory way. So OSHA is accepting comments about the final rule until April 14th, and you can read the full story from our resources section down below. And I think, Allison, you're going to tell us an interesting story about the U.S. Coast Guard inspections.
Yes. So this Tuesday, March 25th, there was a National Transportation Safety Board forum that was devoted to cruise ship safety. This is a tricky subject for the NTSB because the agency's jurisdiction only stretches 12 miles from the shore. But in light of recent incidents, the agency is looking into the ways that this industry is being regulated.
It does seem that there have been lots of cruise ship incidents in the past several years. For example, the Costa Concordia disaster in 2012 and the fires aboard the Carnival Splendor back in 2010 and Carnival Triumph last year.
Exactly. And we also know that where there are incidents like the ones you just mentioned, there are many more near misses. And check out our white paper on tracking near misses to improve safety performance in the resource section of this podcast. Now, in 2013, regular twice-a-year inspections of just 140 cruise ships based at U.S. ports found 251 deficiencies. Most frequently, these were problems with fire doors and lifeboats. So NTSB Chairwoman Debbie Hirschman says that more than 22 million people will take a cruise worldwide this year. Ensuring the safety of these people should be a priority. And so the Coast Guard will now be conducting spot inspections without notice on ships that have a history of safety issues. Hirschman also said she wanted to see more transparency between NTSB investigations and the International Maritime Organization, also known as IMO. IMO is the United Nations agency responsible for the safety, security, and environmental performance of international shipping. So Hirschman is hoping that the organizations can share their lessons more transparently, which certainly sounds ideal. Moving now to a story that's taking place in Peru. Peru is trying to crack down on illegal mining. This week, more than 20,000 unlicensed gold miners are protesting in Peru's capital and various other regions. So what they want is for the government to ease a regulation passed in 2012, which would force miners to register their mining activities by April 19th of this year or face consequences, which include imprisonment. So Peru's president, Ollanta Humala, is not yet giving in. He's repeated that the regulation is needed to stop illegal mining from destroying the Amazon rainforest and affecting the health of locals.
So how big is the illegal gold industry in Peru?
It's actually quite large. So illegal gold production in Peru has increased significantly in the last 6 years and is providing an estimated 100,000 direct jobs in the country. But the sad news is that illegal mining is often associated with the desperately poor working in very risky conditions. So these workers also don't receive the proper training to do their job, which creates a very dangerous situation for everyone involved. In addition to the safety concerns, Peru's Ministry of Environment says that the use of mercury and other toxic elements, which is used by illegal gold miners, has already destroyed 18,000 hectares of the Amazon rainforest. Peru is the world's sixth largest gold producer, but an estimated 20% of its annual production is of unknown origin. The government is trying to cut deals to increase training and help these miners find jobs, so let's hope that there's a peaceful resolution to this issue that leads to safer, more environmentally work-friendly practices for everyone involved. Closer to home, Nicola, I think you have something going on with OSHA.
Actually, I have the European OSHA story. The European Agency for Safety and Health at Work, so EU OSHA, has identified key priority areas for occupational safety and health research that will help Europe reach its 2020 goals. So priorities have been set around four major themes. So the first is demographic change. Second is globalization and the changing world of work. Third is safe new technologies. And fourth is new or increasing occupational exposure to chemical and biological agents.
So what are these priorities going to help accomplish?
Well, setting priorities will allow better coordination of research activities and more efficient allocation of resources in the coming years. This is vital in helping to translate OSH research into practical and accessible workplace solutions that will have an impact on the safety and health of workers. So EU OSHA's response to the challenges currently facing Europe are detailed in a report entitled Priorities for Occupational Safety and Health Research in Europe 2013 to 2020. The report emphasizes the fact that OSH research can contribute to meeting the goals set by the Europe 2020 strategy and the Horizon 2020 program for smart, sustainable, and inclusive growth. If you'd like to find out more about these priorities, you can check out the URL below in the Resources tab. And I think, Allison, you also have a story related to OSHA?
Yes, I do. So unfortunately, it's not a happy story. It's a follow-up to a story that we reported on a couple weeks ago OSHA had sent out a letter to people working in the telecommunication towers industry warning them that the rate of fatalities in the industry was much too high and that safety precautions needed to be taken a lot more seriously. So unfortunately, it seems that some people didn't get the message. Two workers have died in Kansas this week. It happened this Tuesday. They were working at 250 feet when the communication tower they were helping dismantle collapsed. So, you know, these are very high-risk jobs. It's quite obvious at this point. And OSHA has been trying their best to provide resources for these people. These two workers were contract workers, which is something that OSHA is particularly concerned about when it comes to the tower industry, but industries in general. These contract workers are definitely at a higher risk because they don't receive the same kind of training. The same kinds of injury reporting is, you know, the understanding isn't quite there for who is really responsible for these workers' safeties. Is it the contracting organization or is it the people who those people ultimately report to?
In a letter that OSHA sent out to employees in the communication tower industry, it referred to 13 deaths that happened in tower work in 2013, and then 4 deaths that happened in the start of this year, in the first 5 weeks of this year, actually. And then it was mentioned that every single one of the deaths were preventable.
Yeah, and that's always sad when we hear about preventable deaths, right? So OSHA has developed a webpage on their site that is very specifically for the communications tower industry and hopefully, you know, will help some people put together safer work practices and just really understand the risks that they're taking out there. And Nicola, I think you also have a story that is an update to a previous story we covered.
Yes, I have an update on the Malaysian plane crash. So this week we received some clues as to the whereabouts of the missing jet. 122 objects were spotted by satellite floating in the Indian Ocean where officials believe the jet went down. But unfortunately, between the bad weather, the passage of time, and the sheer remoteness of the location, it has hindered the search efforts. So 19 days into the mystery of Flight 370, the discovery of the objects, which ranged in size from 1 to 25 meters, offered the most credible lead that we've had. Aircraft and ships from 6 countries searched the waters far southwest of the Australian coast. Crews saw only 3 objects, one of them blue, and 2 others that appeared to be rope. But search planes could not relocate them or find the 122 pieces seen by a French satellite. They were limited by fuel and distance, and they had to turn back for the night. But the search resumed at first light on Thursday, with 11 planes and 5 ships scouring a search area of 2,500 kilometers southwest of the Australian west coast. And the satellite images captured Sunday are the first to suggest a debris field from the plane rather than just isolated objects. So the items were spotted in roughly the same area as other objects previously seen by Australian and Chinese satellites. But experts caution that the area's frequent high season bad weather and its distance from land complicates an already trying search. The southern part of the Indian Ocean is known for its strong currents, fierce winds, violent storms, 30-foot waves, and heavy weather, which only become heavier in the coming weeks, and most ships tend to avoid it.
This is sort of bittersweet news, isn't it? Hopefully it's providing a little bit of closure for some of these people that don't been waiting to hear what happened to their loved ones on the plane, but at the same time, of course, it's not good news.
So hopefully in upcoming weeks we get some answers to these questions and the families are able to have some closure.
Absolutely.
And I think that's it for the week. We hope you enjoyed this week's stories and we'll talk to you next week.
Have a safe week, everyone.